Welcome, men. Thanks for joining us today. This is our third in the series, Help, I'm Under Attack. Today we're going to look at the subject of financial assault. There are a number of key principles that we discussed during the hour-plus studies that we're engaged in for the morning. But there's a number of points that were left out. Frankly, this is one of the most intense information sessions that we've done recently. I think there was something like 14 or 15 principles, and I didn't touch on some of them. So at the end of the recording that was done live, I'm going to come back and I'm going to go over a few additional points. So if you're listening along because you couldn't make it, or maybe you're one of the regular followers of this podcast, you're familiar with the fact that it typically ends at the end of the live session. I'd like you to continue to listen on, or maybe come back and listen to the remainder of the session at a different time, because there are some additional points that I believe will be very beneficial. But if there are some study notes that you'd like to have access to the material that we use during the morning, please contact us. You can reach out to us at men@mstarqtown.org. That's men@mstarqtown.org. Reach out to us, ask for the study notes, and we'll be happy to get them emailed to you. So guys, I hope you're going to find this beneficial, but the only way that you will find this useful is, first and foremost, if you begin to have meaningful discussions with other people about how to use this stuff. As a matter of fact, unless you're driving and you find it completely impractical to do this, I'd almost suggest that you pause this right now, and before you start to listen to the main session, get a legal pad and a piece of paper, and be prepared to jot down your thoughts, the ones that you gain about your personal financial situation, the decisions that you need to make in your life, maybe the things that you're confronting right now, and how this material is going to speak to decisions that you should make. Because as you'll hear in the very opening moments, an idea that we use again and again, it isn't
so
what you know that counts, it's what you do
with what
you know.
So this is our third week in the series. Last week we took a break. Third week in our series,
Help, I'm Under Attack.
And don't forget to listen on
this is
for
the week, an assault on my finances. There's a lot of stuff here. I'm going to try to move quickly. If you need to put a break in, talk about something, by all means. The interaction is helpful. But I'm just going to be really blunt here. There is so much stuff here that even if we get through it, you're probably not going to remember some of it. So I'd encourage you, if you have someone you meet with, even if you don't have someone you meet with on a regular basis, maybe just talk it over with your wife, find a friend you can talk about this stuff with. Remember a couple of weeks ago we introduced an idea that I hope has stuck? As a matter of fact, I actually heard Scott Baker use the phrase the other evening. And it's not what you know, it's... You have to be quiet. It's not what you know. It's what you do with what you know that counts. So it doesn't matter how much head knowledge we have. It doesn't matter how much knowledge we have that we might use. It's only the portion of what we know that we actually have access to and can put into play at the moments when we have to make decisions. That's the only part that matters. All right, so... Even before we get into the material, how many of you think that intellectually anyway, you know more about financial management than you use? You know more than you use. Okay. So there's a gap between what you know and what you do with what you know. Why?
Because knowing it takes less effort than doing it.
Okay, so there is an effort component to it, sure. At the moment when you're standing, and this is just such an easy, almost lame example, but at the moment when you are standing somewhere and you're making a choice, buy or don't buy, are you engaging in a lot of real financial, deep financial decisions at that time, or are you just acting on impulse? At the moment when you're standing somewhere making a choice about whether you're going to buy something or not buy it, whether you're going to buy this item or whether you're going to buy that item, at that moment, are you engaged in deep financial analysis or are you acting more on impulse?
Depends on the purchase.
Okay. Yeah. Are there a lot of small purchases that we make every day without giving a second thought to? Of course there are. And so what I'm going to say next, that was just a general way of illustrating of the point that I want to make here. The only way that we get to be able to use what we know is if we begin to integrate it into our values and our beliefs and work it right down into the core of who we are so that we don't even have to think. Have you ever just known something even though you couldn't articulate quite why you knew it? And that's because it has been embedded into you. It is so ingrained in you. You have worked with it and used it so often that it's almost second nature. Now, if you're a father, here's one of the ways this happens. You'll tell your kids, don't do that, that's going to go bad for you. And they'll say, why or how do you know? You ever find yourself stumped for an answer at the moment? Or an answer that was actually sensible, that would resonate with them? Well, sometimes it's because we know stuff and we know it at such a deep level that we're not consciously thinking about it all the time. So my encouragement to all of us when it comes to the ideas of financial wisdom, and we're going to go beyond financial management. When it comes to ideas of financial wisdom, it's imperative that we have these things built into our belief systems. All right, so we're just going to take some time to read the opening things. When we do come under financial attack, prepare as if there was an enemy. So I want us to jump right down to principle number one, and then we're going to come back up and discuss this in more detail. Do you have a comprehensive plan for wealth management? And I know some snarky guy is going to say, well, I don't even have any wealth to manage. But that being aside, do you have a comprehensive plan for developing wealth and caring for the wealth and using the wealth that you have acquired? Do you have that? How sophisticated is it? Or do you just kind of take it for granted that everything is going to work out? When we talk about why it is sometimes that we don't seem to have the wealth that we would like, here's what I would like everyone in the room to understand. Before you were ever even born, there were people that were strategizing about you. They were strategizing about the money that you would one day have. And they were planning for how they were going to acquire some of the money that you would earn. Financial institutions, they didn't all just come into existence yesterday, and they didn't just acquire the wealth-generating systems that they have overnight. You, in a very generic sense, have been part of their plan. Large institutions that make things and sell things. You're part of their plan. They understand you as a man. They understand what appeals to you. They understand who you want to be in a general sense, and they tailor their products to make them attractive to you. So believe me when I tell you this, they have a plan for your money. And so the only question that remains then, if they already have a plan for your money, is do you have a more sophisticated and more comprehensive plan for your money than they do? Because if you don't, a large portion of your wealth will be theirs and you won't even understand why. Now that's a deep enough principle that you could wrap your head around that for quite a while. All right, this is going to be some uncomfortable stuff to listen to from time to time, but in the end I think it's going to be encouraging. All men experience financial setbacks. So it's not a matter of whether you're a good man or a bad man, a godly man or an ungodly man. Every single one of us experiences financial setbacks in life. There is nothing that is necessarily indicative of the fact that you have been especially vile or evil if you don't have money. Maybe you've just been a bad financial manager. So we have a financial crisis for one of several reasons. We're sometimes bad stewards of what we have. Well, we understand that. I've got a chunk of money and I misuse it. Here's a more important thing that especially younger people don't take into account. We fail to or underestimate, if not fail to estimate completely, what may happen in the future that changes our circumstances. There's a phrase I've used here before, but I'll use it again. It's not what you know in life that's going to trip you up. It's the things that you never saw coming that are going to perhaps bring you down. Now, he's in the room, so I'm going to use him as an illustration. But it can really give us an appreciation for what can happen in life. So there's Dave in the back of the room, and life is rocking along, and things are good, or at least from the outside they appear good. And then one day something happens to your mate. Does that change your world a little? Does that have any impact on your finances? And that was part of your plan for this year. Do you and I live our lives as if the unexpected won't happen? Just really meditate on that a little bit. Or do you believe that while you cannot predict what's going to happen in the future, that it should be a normal state of affairs to expect that certain bad things are going to happen to you in life, and therefore that you should plan accordingly? In other words, do you have an emergency preparedness plan? You know the thing that the government advertises, like if disaster should strike the country, do you have a place where you would meet with your family? Do you have a plan for all that? Just as importantly, do you have a comprehensive plan for what you're going to do in the event of some bad things happening? And are you planning that way from early on? Is that built into your financial plan? Or does every disaster that comes your way catch you off guard and throw you off balance? Okay, third item. We're unwilling to make changes at the right time and stay in bad situations too long. When you and I do not believe that we are responsible for our wealth, that we are responsible for the security of our family, and I don't mean to distinguish this from God, but I mean ultimately, have you ever heard a young person say, "I just need a job"? Have you ever heard an old person say, "I just need a job"? What are they saying?
I haven't learned anything.
What does it mean when a person says, "I just need a job, I'll do anything"?
They need financial. They need money.
There you go. That's what the person is saying. Do they really want a job? Is a job what they're seeking? Because they're pretty much a generalist. When the phrase is used, "I'll do almost anything," really what they're saying is, "I just need money." Is it a mark of contribution? Have they set themselves up to contribute, or are they just simply indicating, "I'm desperate for money and I'll do almost anything to get it"? As opposed to determining what my purpose is, what my skills are, and what I would like to bring to this world in exchange. In other words, I have value to bring. Because when you have value to bring, you don't need a job. You seek an opportunity to share your value with others. That's a significant difference. All right, so point number one, you don't need more money first. What you need is a plan. So here's one illustration that I have, and then we're going to move on to point number two. I don't know how many of you are really movie fans. I love watching good movies. So we'll say a movie is an interesting story about some chain of events, right? What's a commercial?
An interruption.
Well, it is an interruption, but more to the point, remember what we said earlier, that there are people in this world who already have a plan for your money.
Yeah, they want you to buy their product, spend your money.
So what is the commercial? Dig deep here. If the movie is a story about somebody else, what is the commercial? It's a story about who you will become if you have this product. It's a story about who you'll be if you have this car. How attractive you'll be if you wear this or buy that. How happy you'll be if you eat this or go there. It is a story designed to appeal to who you want to be. That's why I said they already know you better sometimes than you know yourself.
Well, I think you may have said this before, which is true. You're on the internet, you're doing your stuff and that, but if you ever go look at one product or one keeps popping back up, that come by me, they know what you're interested in, what you've looked at, so they're going to keep coming back, popping that up.
All right. Principle number two, choice is a natural state of existence for people. Have you ever stayed in a bad situation because you felt powerless to do anything? You ever felt locked in a bad situation? Have you ever said, I just don't have a choice about this? The reality is that one of the greatest gifts that God gives us is the ability in any situation to assess and to choose. Now, that doesn't mean that you have control over your circumstances. We're not saying that. There are things outside your ability to influence that happen to you every day. Have you ever lived in a state of powerlessness, pretending to play the victim, rather than saying, in this moment, what are all the options that I have and what is the best one that I can take? And I think every one of us has played the powerless victim from time to time. When are we most likely to do that? When are we most likely to have, and contrast that with, when are we most likely to have the courage to choose well? And so I say this because I believe many of us stay in situations long beyond what we should. Work that we should have left years ago because it's either unfulfilling or it's not meaningful, or maybe, as I'm going to say later on here, you've become the big fish in a small pond. Have you ever complained about how little money you make or that you don't really make enough money? And yet you're really good at what you do? Have you ever been caught in that conflict? I really am good at what I do, but I'm not making enough money doing it. And at that point, you have become the biggest fish in a small pond. And there's a certain comfort there that comes from excelling at something, even though you know. So we're going to really make this understandable. Suppose that there was such a thing as the master burger flipper. There was not a better burger flipper in the world, and you could be that burger flipper. What do you think your prospects for a brisk and lively financial future would be as the master burger flipper? Do you see what I'm saying?
Unless you own the burger flipping place.
Unless you
get multiple burger flipping places.
Yeah. Some of us stay on too long in situations because we prize security more than opportunity. All right, your circumstances may dictate what you can't do, but they can't prevent you from choosing creative alternatives. Here's another principle. Principle number four, there are an abundance of success and happiness models out there. Have you ever gone into a bookstore? I mean, bookstores are not really the thing anymore because you can download almost everything you need to read. But back in the days when bookstores were kind of popular and there were big chains of them around the world and you used to be able to go in there and there was lots of stuff. Have you ever gone to the self-help section in a bookstore? It's a big one. Now, if you're a reader, this is something that you have discovered. If you pick up five self-help books off the rack, sooner or later, you're going to find things that are in direct contradiction to each other. This guy has a theory about what's going to work in your life. That guy has a theory about what's going to work in your life. The next guy has a theory about what's going to work in your life. And they almost completely contradict each other. It would be impossible to merge all of these success strategies into a single one. How are you going to choose what you follow in life? I mean, you are where you are. You're doing what you're doing. You work where you work. You do all this stuff because presumably you had some plan for your life. What informed your plan? Whose success strategy are you following right now? Do you know? And is it proven? That's why when we turn to something like the pages of Scripture, we're not talking about new information. We're not talking about new information that's never been tried and tested before. We're not talking about something that's not been proven out. So when I place the weight of my confidence on biblical principles, I am placing them on things that have been lived out by thousands of people already. They've been lived out over multiple generations so that we can't use the excuse, oh, well, it might have worked then, but it won't work today. You ever heard that? That might have worked at one time, but it won't work. These are general purpose principles that will work across time, across geography, in almost any culture. All right. So, take some time. Incidentally, let me back up and ask that. Where do I get the principles for living that I'm going to live by? Why are you living the way you're living? Let's have a little discussion on that right now.
Parents.
Okay. Anybody else? Parents is a huge one. There's a migration that takes place. Gradually, you will move from being influenced by parents to then being influenced by friends to then being influenced by... At what point in time do you become the predominant influencer of your future?
I was going to say it depends more on acquired wisdom and experience as you get older.
Okay, so when you're young, you have very little wisdom and experience of your own, so you rely on that of others. And as you age, hopefully you acquire a larger body of experience and then can pick and choose. Yes?
You become master of your destiny when you decide to. Because I know there are people, when I was 15, they had a 30-year plan. And let me tell you, they followed it, and now they own hundreds of dorms and colleges, and they're raking it in. And then there's other people who allow circumstances to jockey them about, and they're still doing it. It's the opposite of two extremes, but I don't think there's any definitive point where you can say, well, here's where a person in general is going to become the master of the destiny. You become that when you decide you're going to.
I hope everybody heard what he said, because there's something really important there. What distinguishes one person who at 15 has a plan and ends up somewhere from another person who has a different set of beliefs? So let's contrast the person who at 15 or 18 or whatever that age is has some sort of what they believe is a comprehensive. Now we know it's not a fully comprehensive because they don't know the future any more than you and I do. But what distinguishes that person from the person who never, as he says, takes control of his destiny?
They act on a plan.
They act on a plan based on a certain level of belief that this is possible. Would you ever act on a plan that you thought was so outlandish it was impossible? Do you see what I'm saying? Before the plan comes a belief and a confidence in who I am. Because if I was 15 and I saw somebody else's plan, and I believe that they could make that plan work, and all I would need to do was copy their plan, and I could be as successful as they were, but I didn't have the confidence to believe that I could copy their plan, would I do that? Of course not. And I would settle for something much less. You see how profound this is? Where does a sense of confidence in who I can become come from? Certainly parents can give some of that or take it away. Who else? Did I see your hand?
Say parents. Say family stuff.
All right, so put a pause in there right now, because now the victim, the powerless person, is going to say, but my parents never.
Teachers?
Yes.
What do you say?
Teachers. There are some people that get exposure to a great teacher, maybe a great coach, maybe a great friend. There are a number of opportunities, but at some point in time, and until you're aware of something, you can be excused for not acting on it. Once you're made aware of the fact that there is a great deal of importance that you need to place on your belief, your confidence in your ability to do something, then you need to start to roll the tape back and ask, what level of confidence do I have and where did it come from? How many times here have we talked about lies that are put into us? Are you carrying around any lies with you every day about who you can't be based on what has been put into you in the past?
Definitely.
One of the reasons that we come together in an environment like this is to encourage each other to become reacquainted with, and it's not like we've never heard the message, but remember what I said, it's not what you know, it's what you do with what you know, and you can't do something with what you know unless it is so ingrained in your belief system that it becomes natural to act that way. We come into environments like this so that we can remind ourselves of what we already know, that we can refresh our thinking and our spirit, and we can start to embed those things into our beliefs and values. Okay. Principle number 8, there's no lack of opportunity, only a lack of awareness. We've kind of talked about that already. There's a phrase that has become very popular in the last couple of years. Income. No? Nobody's going to fill that blank in? Income inequality. Have you heard the phrase income inequality anytime in the news? No? Okay, it's become almost a buzz phrase. And what's the message behind it? Well, income inequality says that there is a growing gap between those who have and those who don't. And that forgive me for saying it this way, but the game of life has been rigged in such a way that some people always land on Boardwalk and Park Place and get those places and put hotels on them, and some people always are destined to win the Monopoly game because of the rules of the game.
This is nothing new.
Is that where we should focus our attention? Because there are many in government, there are many, many well-meaning people who say that we need to adjust the board game. In fact, the only thing that we should be concerned about is opportunity, and that's where there needs to be equality. Is there opportunity equality? Do you have the same mind that your neighbor has? Do you have the same set of eyes, the same set of ears? Can you look out around you and see opportunity the same as your neighbor can?
Can I interject this? The thing is, now that is America. That is the foundation of America, a free society. Opportunity to work and make wealth and gain wealth. That's the concept of America, what you're saying.
You know what many of us settle for? Security. And we'll take a little security over opportunity and risk, many of us, every day. Now, admittedly, there's a need for a certain level of security. Right? If you have 5 kids and a wife at home and the wife is not working, so there's 6 mouths that need to be fed every night, then you need a little bit of certainty in your life, do you not? It would make you a bad steward, honestly, if you didn't have a little bit of certainty in your life. But the reality is that at some point in time, a lot of us just let what could be slip away from us because we literally trade in the opportunity in our lives in exchange for what we believe is a guaranteed security. And yet we know there's no guarantees. How many of you at least know someone who was working in a good job 10 years ago and is no longer working in that job or in that field? So what does that say? That the security that we thought we had is only a myth anyway. It comes back to what he said about confidence and where you place it. The man who trades opportunity for security, what is he saying? Think about this.
It's
I trust the people that are going to give me security more than I trust who? Myself. I trust them to know how to make my life better more than I trust me to know how to make my life better. Now here's the interesting thing. Who should have a bias toward making life work for you? Yeah, if anybody should have a bias to want to make their life work, it should be each of us. Not the place or the institution that you've placed all your confidence and trust in. Now, it's not that they're vile or wicked or mean badly for you. They may want good for you. But it should be your choice to make them a part of your personal security plan that you confidently strike out to achieve. It should not be your desperation to trust them for security because you don't trust yourself as much as you trust them. All right, so if you're under the age of, we'll say, 35, the next point is probably for you. It's been studied numerous times, and generally speaking, most people that have a significant fortune are well up into their 40s and 50s. Why do you suppose that is? Apart from reading my notes.
It takes time to build a foundation.
Gradual, slow, incremental effort applied in an area where you are an expert will tend to yield good results. It's not a guarantee. Remember, it's an opportunity. It's a chance for. When you're young, what are you looking for? For the most part, let's be honest. Right. How many of you have ever been into a Wawa and watched the line at the lottery ticket machine?
Oh, yeah.
Do you hear what I'm saying? I mean, I've stood there and watched it be, and I mean stood off to the side. Not because I've got some moral, righteously indignant set of values that would say, oh, that was a wicked person. But I'm telling you, who stands in line for half an hour to wait for the chance to put $25 or $50 or even $100 in a little box and get a ticket out so they can scratch? What are they there for? Hope. Again, coming back to confidence. What are they really saying? There's a better chance that I'm going to strike it rich from a ticket out of this machine than if I actually apply myself to something, because I actually trust that box more with my $100 than I trust me with it.
I always think it's something that people get lottery tickets as a Christmas present. Here you go.
Now listen, if you're here and you buy lottery tickets every week, that's your choice, okay? So if I've stepped on a few toes, well, just don't tell me, and then I won't know I stepped on your toes, that's all. All I'm saying is, a desire to get rich quick because we're unwilling to do the hard work to build a foundation and systematically develop a system for creating wealth is going to take us to dumb and stupid places. I mean, I've seen it. Maybe you've seen it. People will go from squandering their wealth in one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. I know a guy, I knew him from a former church that I went to. He's a young guy. His dad and he had a business, and I'm not going to get into the details of the business, but it was a reasonably good business. It could have been a great business, but they failed to manage it well. He was accustomed to living the life of a business person. They built a nice house. He got married, started a family, and everything in the business went really bad really quickly. And for the next 10 years, and as a matter of fact, I think even till right now, he's just chased one opportunity, one crazy opportunity after another. in the hopes of somehow he would, and he literally took the bait for almost every kind of... You ever had one of those things come to you where if you just give $5,000 or $10,000, we'll teach you how to this, and in no time you'll be making... And you've asked yourself, or at least I hope you've asked yourself, who does that? Who gives their $5,000 to that? And I say, I hope you've asked that. Well, this was the guy. He did. And not just once, but multiple times. Listen, the secret to, and there's no secret to it, the secret to wealth accumulation is to gradually, systematically put a plan in place, become expert at doing something that has a reasonable chance of compensating you well. It sounds so easy, doesn't it? And yet most of us don't do that. It might be time to pause for any comments or questions, at, you know, instead of just listening to me babble for an hour straight. What are you laughing at, Jim? It certainly is. I mean, there's definitely a difference. As a matter of fact, we could even say that capitalism, which is not reined in by some sort of a solid moral system. In other words, I'm going to say it like this. Capitalism that is not reined in by a living, active Christian faith can go badly really quickly. Unbridled capitalism is always the pursuit of more. Unbridled capitalism is capitalism that is not fenced in by a certain set of solid values. That's why this country did well for so long, and I'm not saying that, oh, that was the good old days and all hope is lost. I'm not that guy. What's that?
You should.
But the reality is that there is something powerful about personal work ethic, seeking opportunity, that is fenced in by standards, values of how we treat each other. And that when we forget how we are to treat each other and we simply look out for ourselves, things go bad, badly, quickly. As a matter of fact, let's turn over to Philippians, the second chapter. All right, so we'll start at the first verse. So if there's any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord, and of one mind. All right, so he's talking to a group of believers, and what he's saying is, don't any longer treat yourselves, treat each other as just individuals. Relate to each other as a living body, a living family. He says, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. And that's exactly what he's saying. See, when I do not build something, let's come back to the opportunity thing. When I build something, and the only reason that I am building something, and I mean building something that generates wealth, the only reason that I am doing that is to make me happier, to make more money for me. What do I view all of you as? You're useful pawns in the game that I have that makes more for me. But if I view opportunity that I am pursuing as something that can bless and benefit everyone, then what do I see all of you as? Perhaps partners, perhaps allies, perhaps people who will benefit from that blessing, perhaps people who can help me with that. So all of you become not people that I can use, but people whom I can bless. This is one of the amazing things about Jewish culture. And for centuries, Jews were maligned because they were generally, well, we know the story, more financially successful. Why is that? How is it that a Jewish population could be driven out of a country, driven out of an area, they could be forced into another area, and in reasonably short time, they were prospering there?
Networking.
They cared for each other. What else? Yes, they do. Yes, they did.
Their biblical foundation, the principles they live by.
They have a good, solid foundation. Here's what several rabbis have said to kind of refute the idea that somehow there's something magical or mystical about the way Jews make money. He said, in a typical Jewish household, from the time a boy is young, his father is teaching him sound financial practices. Not predatory practices, sound financial practices. In a typical Jewish household, it is believed that you are given things for the benefit of helping and blessing other people. And so in a Jewish mindset, every time that you sell something to somebody, what you are actually doing is meeting a need and providing something that they really want. And you're providing them value. Good value. Now suppose that you have an entire community of people that is seeking to bless each other while at the same time they are having their needs met. Suppose that they go out of their way to give people what they believe the people want. To bring their best to it. Suppose you had a whole community that actually lived that way. What do you think it would look like? And in a way, that's what Paul is calling us back to. And to appreciate that, you have to keep in mind he's writing to a Gentile population that would have been predominantly looking at how do I get mine first? So when he says these words and he says, I'd like you to think of others as if they were better than you, he's not really saying that you should consider yourself to be a doormat and unworthy of any good thing. What he's saying is, you have become accustomed to looking out for number one. And a community cannot be a rich and full community if everybody is looking out for number one. Now put this together with this other concept. Remember what we said, that into every human's life is going to probably fall some financial adversity. As a matter of fact, if you look at the story of the patriarchs, every one of them had bad stuff happen to them. Financial reversal after financial reversal. When you're in a community where everybody is looking out for number one, and I'm using the term community and it's really not community, where everybody is looking out for number one, where is your hope when things go bad for you? You don't, do you? But when you are in a community where everyone is serving each other, looking out for each other, while they go about the business of developing their own wealth system, then everyone has an opportunity to thrive and to prosper. This is, incidentally, God's plan for how we care for the poor. This is God's plan for how we care for each other. That's the first and the foremost plan. See, if we would actually live like this, even if believers would actually live like this, I got a newsflash for you. There's a lot of Christians who really don't live the way this book says. Okay, there's a lot of believers who really don't live with an idea that they are looking to bless and to benefit other people.
Leadership was reaping those profits, but the workers were not. So they became less engaged, less productive, and the company soon became less profitable and collapsed. So it's really a hand-to-hand relationship. And just like we were talking about the Jewish community, it works when everybody works together.
It does, and it only takes a little while for this to slip away. It only takes one generation of, we'll call it, excessive greed to evaporate a lot of goodwill and a lot of what was good community. It doesn't take that long. And once the trust is lost, so for instance, how much trust do we have in our major institutions in this country today? Come on, can we give it at least 1%? Okay, where does that come from?
Experience.
Yeah, experience. What will it take to earn that trust back? So suppose tomorrow, all of a sudden, I don't know, God were to have a magic wand and He were to change the thinking of every single human that runs, is involved in management of a major institution, and they were all to start thinking and acting in ways that were good for everyone. How long would it take for trust to be restored? You bet. It's like, how many acts of adultery does a guy have to commit in his marriage before his wife doesn't trust him? And how long does it take for trust to be restored? And that's what we have going on here. Fortunately, in grace-filled communities where we understand, and this, I'm so glad John says this a lot, you're a sinner, you married a sinner, you've had little sinners as a result of getting married, and the little sinners grow up to be big sinners, and they go out and they populate the earth with still more sinners. Right? And when we get this, then we can start to show some grace. So when we say we have no confidence in our institutions, in our major institutions, the reality is that apart from the fact that some people are unusually corrupt, we all deep down inside, if we're honest, know that we are not that much different than they. We all have a sin nature, and given the right opportunity, any one of us is liable to stray unless we keep guard. I've talked too long. It's your turn.
But is it possible to have it go wrong the other way? You say, you know, there's the business mind that doesn't think about the individual and then things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Is there the mind that is too focused on the individual and the business collapses because of that? Because I have examples in my life, very personal ones, where I'm looking at this person's life going, okay, you're investing so much time, everyone else around you, that your life is collapsing and you don't see it. You can't see that, and I'm not sure why. You know, it's a family member, actually. So how do you approach that? You know what I mean? How do you address that?
Okay, so
opposite of what you're same coin, different face.
Well, the opposite of what I'm describing, I think, would be it, when we say that we have no trust for our major institutions, when we have no trust for large organizations, even large companies, and that we'd say that they have taken advantage of individuals. The opposite can be true in this sense, and this is where I thought you were going. Remember the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Yep.
It's not that old. Okay, so the 99% opposed to the 1% because they felt the 1% had all of the opportunities and the 99% were the downtrodden and had nothing. Now, what do we know to be true, we who are believers in Christ, what do we know to be true about sin? Is sin limited to the 1%? So the sin nature and the sin thinking pervade 100%. Which means while there are no perfect organizations or institutions, and sometimes they are very corrupt, there are also no perfect people, and that employees can contribute as much to a problem as employers. But that's not what you were saying.
Well, I'm having a difficult time phrasing the question, so perhaps it's a moot point.
circle around and think about it for another moment or two and come back. Ron?
Related to what Scott was saying, I think some companies, as they get larger, publicly traded, lose their focus on employees and are more concerned about stockholders having an extra penny today. And that's all that matters.
Oh, there's no question about that. There's no question about that. And pressure is put on... And pressure is certainly put on them by large financial institutions that have invested significantly in the public company. So insurance funds and all of that is at stake. So when we lose sight of everybody's best interest, it all starts to degrade and fall apart.
Just look at the schools.
Bring me more.
Look what's happened to the schools over the last 20, 30 years with wages up and up and up and up, and everybody's up and up, moving ahead, eventually getting away from why they're there. Now, push comes to shove, they can't get back to why they're there. They start trying to buy these people out, and still going down. It's just like it's a model of what everybody's talking about here. If you look at stuff around you, the steel industry, the auto workers industry, you look at all those things over the years, it's basically doing the same thing that everybody's talking about. Everybody can relate to these things. They're out there right outside the door or something. It's the same thing. People do, years ago, like this gentleman said, when you went to work, where did you hear the word CEO in the 60s? Where did you hear they're getting multi-million dollars after they retired? It didn't happen. I mean, it just didn't happen. People didn't work, and they worked for the company and built the company, and employees stayed there. Today, that's completely wrong. And if you're to get back to that, it's harder than going the other way. Because you put yourself, not at a loss, but you're not going to put yourself on the same level as a guy who's out to make $1 million after you retire. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
I do know what you're saying.
You're going to say, okay, I'm going to make a comfortable living here, and the rest is going back into this company. That's difficult to say instead.
Now, we're going to return to that thought in a moment. Before I do that, do you see why we, the church, are so important? There are certain things that the church, and I mean the body of Christ, the people who, you and I, ambassadors of this new kingdom, where we understand how to make, and we don't understand it because we were naturally gifted or born with this understanding, but we have been given a trust, and the trust is the truth of the gospel that actually works if we put it into play. It's our job. Don't expect the world to change. The world's solution, and I don't mean to say this and make the world sound evil and ugly and negative, but the world doesn't really have solutions that work. So every 20 or 30 years, there's a new program that we put in place to try to fix what was broken. And what does the new program do? It just leads to a different collection of brokennesses. It might fix one problem, but the unintended consequences of fixing the one problem are 5 new problems. And we see that. Now, it's never going to be perfect because we live in, and this sounds very biblical, but we live in a fallen world. We live in a world where each of us has the propensity to sin, and at any given moment we can do something that would violate that good community spirit. I said I was going to come back to what he said, and I want to do that now. There's 2 principles that I think we need to weave together. You cannot understand how to use wealth or why you should have wealth until you understand your purpose. Everyone's purpose should be intimately connected to their wealth. Why else do you need wealth apart from living out a purpose? What is wealth apart from having a purpose? It's simply a way to indulge yourself. And for that reason, everyone's wealth, because everyone's purpose is slightly different, everyone's measure of wealth will be slightly different. There was a time when, speaking to what he said, a teacher wanted to become an educator because they actually valued the opportunity to educate kids. They believed that would make a major contribution to our country, to society, and they felt that they were uniquely called and gifted to do that. What is one of the primary motivators, it would seem, at times, of educators today? Easy. I didn't expect quite that level of contribution. Okay, but we all kind of feel that, don't we? Has it ever occurred to anyone to just stand up and say, listen, if you don't like the job, get another one?
My son, who is a relatively new teacher, because teachers eat together and there's a break together to talk, and he's heard a number of them with many years of experience complaining and negative and that. Say that very same thing to them. You kind of talk about, boy, this isn't so bad for you that you get paid for 12 months, you work this many months, and all that. And he knows now the challenges of teaching and the stress of teaching and paperwork, but there's the bottom line. He said, if this is so bad, why don't you get another job? Was it?
Yeah.
Everybody
didn't
stand up and applaud him when he said that.
No, I'm sure they didn't. You see what happens? We become, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but we just become wage whores. That's all we are. When we get to that point, all we have done is decided that we are going to sell part of who we are for a buck. Why is that important? Remember what I said, that until you have a purpose for living, you really should not be deserving of wealth. And because of that, everyone's wealth is going to be different. The reality is we have kind of a herd mentality in community. We want to basically look alike. You know, if you're going to be truly successful and live on purpose, and it's there in the notes somewhere, you're going to live a lopsided life. How many of you have ever heard about life balance? It was a popular phrase. It still is a popular phrase. And I don't negate the need to bring into some sort of control all the components of your life. You can't completely neglect one area of your life in order to pursue something else. But the truth is, if you are going to live a purpose-filled and significant life, your life is going to be lopsided. It's going to look different than everyone else's. Because the needs that are associated with your unique purpose are going to give you certain things that no one else has, but they're also going to mean that you have absolutely none of what other people have. But you have to be okay with that.
This is where Paul says, be content. If you know your purpose, you're living it out, you can be content. If not, you're going to have your strife and struggle.
So I want to come back now to another thing. What is money to me? It's under principle number 10, until you know what you really want, don't go shopping. What is wealth to you? Okay, and this is really, really personal, so we're just going to ask it a different way. What is wealth to your neighbor? Because it's always fun to talk about your neighbor. What does wealth represent to him?
Status.
Security. Have you ever felt inadequate in a crowd of people because you didn't quite feel like you had what they had? Have you ever felt like you were out of your depth? Like you needed to go back to a smaller pond where the fish were more like you and they had kind of like the same gills and the same... Scott?
You're talking about community. Because you can be in a social gathering. So inadequate because of your level of income, that is a misnomer. Because if you're in a social gathering with, let's say, a bunch of doctors, and you happen to be, there's a great disparity in income. However, you as a retail clerk may not have the debt that a doctor has, because the doctor has to maintain a level of status because of their position, which means that as a doctor, you're expected to have a nice house, you're expected to have a nice car, you're expected to travel, you're expected to pay your insurances. And with that comes an enormous amount of debt that is below the surface in that social setting. That clerk does not see the debt to income disparity. That doctor might be under so much pressure because he doesn't know how he's going to pay the next bill, where the retail clerk might not have that pressure. But then the retail clerk feels so insignificant because of his occupation. So we talk about wealth and purpose and status and happiness. It really is a personal decision.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, I've been a believer for 30 years, and I look back over the years, and just what we're sharing here, there's a certain situation, you feel like you're a little overwhelmed because the people you're with, what they have, what they don't have, so forth and so on, and we've all somewhat, I guess, some time in our life, typically, in a certain situation. But I look at it this way now, each and every day, and some of the things that have been bothering, that, you know what, I have something. I have something that some of these people may not have. That's what God has called me to do. Okay, so can I do something what I have to do without compromising, which we should do as believers? I have something really special. I have something that was given to me that's free. And you know what? I have the ability to try to tell them, you know what? You may have this and you may have that, but you know what? There's something else that you could really use that could really change your life, your purpose. That's where I'm at right now. And I have to honestly say, there's not a situation where I'm in where I don't have a chance to be able to share one little way or a little outside of finances. And you know what? I thank God every day for those situations, because you know what? It has nothing to do with me, but everything to do with him. And it's, I just enjoy being used by him.
It's good. It's good.
Did you remember?
Ha! You answered the question already.
Oh, okay.
Until very recently, I worked in mental rehab area, working with clients, that kind of thing, taking them around. And as such, I heard some stories about certain situations. There was a family that had, they were filthy rich, big house, three cars, all of them were over $60,000. Blah 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 blah. Oh my God. They had a son that had an issue with, he would have this thing where most of the time he spent completely unable to move, and then he'd have this issue where suddenly he would get up and run around uncontrollably, and then have a seizure and fall down wherever he was.
Okay.
And so in order to offset that, they pretty much moved their entire life into one room of the house. They padded the fireplace. Everything was padded. Oh my God, TV, everything, kitchen, everything was in that one little living room. And that's where they spent their life. And this guy, he told the organization that I worked for, the staff that was helping him out, he goes, I am worth well over $90 million. He goes, I would trade every penny of it to have a normal life. He was just to go on vacation in a camper, in a pop-up camper, in a tent. He goes, I'd trade every cent that I have for a normal life. And my wife and I have discussed this very often. You know, we have friends that are worth way more money than we are. But I look at what we have. We have two awesome, beautiful kids who are intelligent and mature and beyond their years and healthy. And we are healthy. And I might work 6 days a week, but you know what? I am rich in so many areas where my friends are not. And sometimes I catch them looking at me with jealousy. Because, you know, I can go to a house where people make, infinitely amounts more money than I have. And I can enjoy myself because I love what I have. I know what I have. And it's taken a long time to get to that point. But when you get there, it's amazing to realize how rich you really are. And what you were saying, what you have that other people do not. You know?
The power in that statement is in when you really get to the point where you fully believe that. And there's a lot of people in church circles that will say that. Oh, I'm just thankful for this. But you know what? On the inside, they're churning with envy anyway. While they spout the cliches about real wealth is your health and your family and all that. But when you come to the point where godliness with contentment is great gain. And I believe that God has given each of us a unique purpose and a unique work to do. When you're aligned with that and you find satisfaction in what you're doing and your wealth then becomes the means to support that, whatever level of wealth that is.
And then when I think you're there and you honor God with your finances, He can trust you with more when you're at that place.
Let's come right down to principle number 9. A prepared person with prepared purpose is fit to hold wealth. We're just going to read this verse from Revelations. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Now this is Jesus that it's talking about. To receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. So the question isn't, are these good or bad things? And notice on the list is wealth. It presumes that every one of these things is a good and a right thing to have. But it's all predicated by a simple thing. Who's worthy to be a container for that? It says, in this case, Jesus is a worthy container that is deserving, ultimately, of all of this. So the question then is, if we want this, exactly like John said, are we suitable vessels for it? Would we know what to do with it if we got it? Because we all know people who have a lot. And this is not to negate the value of wealth. You know what poor people usually do? Poor people usually judge rich people and say, well, they're probably not happy anyway. And it's not because they're really concerned about whether the rich person is happy or not. They're just kind of envious, but they don't know what else to say. So they say that because it sounds pious. Okay, let's just call it the way it is. There is nothing bad about wealth, but if you're not the right vessel, what's wealth going to do except get you into more trouble? If a little money will get you into a little trouble because you don't have the right character, what would a lot of money do? And don't we see that?
Sports.
Yeah, right. Say no more. Sports. A night on the town can get in the news for a long time, can it? All right. There's two final facts that I want to deal with here. Not facts, but ideas anyway. It takes a long time to fully step into who you are and what your purpose is. I mean, I got to say, it took me a number of years. Let's just say decades, okay? We may as well just date me for what I am. So it's taken me a few decades to step in. You're older than I am, so don't you dare laugh, okay? But once you gradually step into a confidence as to why you're here and what you're here for, then you start to reconfigure your life around why you're here. So let's take a look at somebody's first house. And this is just kind of a really lame illustration that I came up with. Your first home. And most homes are pretty much cookie cutter things, right? You go into a typical home and what is it? Come on, we can all call out the rooms in the home. Yeah, right. They're all pretty much laid out essentially the same. I mean, there's a few variables on the outside and all that. But suppose you had 40 or 50 years to live. How would you design your personal home if you were building it from scratch and money was not the object? How would you design your home to fit you instead of you fitting your home? And this is what we're talking about life. When you finally step into who you are as a person
and your purpose for life, you start to design everything in your life around fulfilling your purpose. And that, as I've said before, is going to make you unique and distinct and look like no one else on the planet. And unless you're secure in who you are, you're going to feel a little awkward because you're going to look like no one else. And
I have an attitude about that. I find that when I have struggles and I'm not sure about something, I kind of look at the big picture and understand, look, I am who I am. But I put or help put those people in those positions. So I am successful. I'm successful in making paying taxes so they can have a salary. I'm successful in that. I'm successful in the borough. I'm successful in the state. I'm successful in everything I do. Even though I don't have what they have financially, I have what I want to have. And I'm a success in that also. So I don't look at myself as the bottom of the barrel. I look at myself as right up there with everybody else. They're there because of people like us that work hard, have the right attitude, are honest, you know, have the right ingredients inside them to get where they are. That's helped me my whole life. Once I realized that, I'm never going to fail. I'm never going to fail. No matter what I do, I'm not going to fail.
Good.
So that's really kind of helped me. We look at it 100 different ways, and everybody does look at it the wrong way. But that to me is really pretty cut and dry. And I have that attitude when I go places, just things have changed. Once you say that to people, look, teachers. That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. We want the teacher. Meetings and stuff, you know, for your kids' life. I said, look, just remember who pays you. I'm not here to start a problem. I'm here to get it figured out, but just remember why you're here. You know, remember that. Just remember that. I don't know, people kind of look at you a whole different way after that. But it's true. It's absolutely true.
What he meant to say was when he came for parent-teacher conferences, the teacher suddenly was out of the room.
Well, it comes down to what Scott was saying. You go to the big dinner, and you got the doctors and the lawyers, and they have that certain persona. And they're not better than you are. They're just not. You help them put in there. And they just... It's like you're not.
Let me add to that, and here's the struggle. And I got to say that I'm right there with you, okay? But I think there even comes a level of maturity that it's above that. It's when it no longer works you up that they think they are that. So the first step is to understand, yes, we all are equal on the playing field if we're doing excellently at what we do. But the next step is to not let it shake you up anymore. And I think Jesus was able, and I know we use Jesus as the example for everything, and it might get tiring, but it seems to imply in the Gospels that Jesus was very secure in the company of people who from every social measure far exceeded him in stature and power and authority, and yet he moved fluidly and seamlessly in those crowds, and it doesn't seem as if he was at all shaken or rattled. That's quite something to attain to. I think it takes most of us an entire lifetime to get there.
I'll tell you what it does. What's your priorities? It makes you focus on things that you should be focused on.
And see, you're no longer not only jealous of other people or envious of their positions, but you can actually be happy for them. Not happy if they're self-destructing, but happy for them in what they have. But the only way you can be happy for what somebody else has is if you can really first learn to be content and appreciate what you have. And that's a really hard thing for most of us to do.
Yep.
And as a matter of fact, I think I'm not even going to do the last point. I think we're going to just close right there. You'll notice that there's a few things that haven't been covered yet. Take this home. Take a look through it. Talk some stuff through. All right. We're back for the bonus material now. And I may pause this during the recording a couple of times to recollect my thoughts. It just occurred to me after we had wrapped up on Saturday morning that there were some things that I had left unsaid, some of which needed to be said to bring some clarification and settle some spirits about things they might have heard that were uncomfortable to them. The other thing is there are a couple of additional helpful points, but I don't have this well organized, so I'm sort of doing it on the fly, so forgive me if it does sound a little bit rambling and jumbled. Well, here's one of the first points that I'd like you to take away from this. There are some purposes, and you heard us talk a lot this morning about purpose. There are some purposes that just seem to be part of who we are. It's almost like, and I don't want to use the word destiny casually or indifferently, but it's almost as if this is, as the scripture says, the good work that God has planned and prepared for us before the foundation of the earth. And that by itself is an interesting point. Remember, one of the early points that we made is that even before most men have a plan for their own finances, there are institutions and organizations that have existed long before they came of financial awareness age that have already had a plan for, in general terms, using up their money. In other words, our money. For convincing us that we needed to buy certain things, spend in certain ways, develop patterns of spending that would separate us from the wealth that we could acquire otherwise. Well, just the same as there are institutions and even individuals who have a plan for our finances, and if we don't have a plan for our own finances, they'll be glad to help us with that planning. Isn't it encouraging to know that God has a plan for your life? And that's the promise of Scripture, that God does have a plan for your life. In other words, He has a reason for you to be here alive and well and walking around on planet Earth. He has a reason for that. Now, some of that plan we find our way into. But some things along the way, we select. We choose if we're going to marry or stay single. We choose then, many times, if we're going to have children or not. Well, even if we don't choose, we know that certain things are going to lead to having children, and therefore certain choices that we make open us up to the likelihood of having children. So when I say that we need to carefully craft a plan for life, when you pick up certain purposes, and getting married is a purpose, having children is a purpose, because that makes you a husband, and husbanding is a purpose-oriented life. Fathering is a purpose-oriented life. And so there are certain responsibilities that come along with those purposes. So you cannot neglect those purposes in order to go off and fill some what you perceive to be grand plan for your life if achieving the grand plan separates you from the purposes that you have voluntarily walked into. God gives us great latitude and great freedom in that regard. If you've chosen to be a husband, that's a noble call. If you've chosen to be a father, that's a noble call. So find contentment and satisfaction there, and understand that a large percentage of your wealth generation and wealth management is going to revolve around, at least for some periods of time, caring for a family. So don't feel as if that's a second-rate form of purpose if that's where you are right now. All right, there's another component to this that I'd like to talk about. The first 2 weeks in the series, Help, I'm Under Attack, first dealt with what difference can one man make, the lie that we often buy into that says that one man can't make a difference. And in fact, when we push back against that and we find out that each of us is here to make a difference, that makes all the difference in the way we manage our finances. But the second component that we talked about, the second attack that comes against us, is temptation that slowly and subtly leads us off purpose and away from what we're called to do. As a matter of fact, I suggested in an email that I wrote later in an article that, in fact, all temptation is ultimately an assault on why we're here. It's an assault on our purpose. It's an attempt to convince us to settle for something less than the real and highest callings to which we're here for. Well, it's that way when it comes to managing our finances. And here's what happens. When we succumb to the temptation to settle for less, to go after things that are not necessarily bad, but are less than the best, we sometimes go after things that place us in positions where we wouldn't ordinarily be, or we wouldn't be if we had stayed true to our purpose. And once we're off course, if you will, once we have strayed into that area, we are, as it were, foundationless, because the foundation of a successful life is character, which calls us toward purpose. When we stray by succumbing to temptation, we've stepped off of that foundation. And so what we then do is have to rationalize and justify, and we build a secondary foundation under our lives. So it's almost like a man who has chosen to build his, and we'll sort of play into Jesus' words here, a man who has chosen to build his house on the rock, but instead, over a period of time, he gradually sees things closer to the shoreline, closer to the sand. And he says, I think I'd like to build part of my house over there. And that's what temptation is. Temptation is a lure to go toward the less stable. And so the man goes out after that. But he realizes he's on unsolid ground, and so he attempts to build his own foundation. Not a foundation on God's call and purpose for his life, but he chooses to build his own foundation under his life. And so in the end, because we all know, any of us who have any concept of building structure, we all know that the size, the scope, the magnitude of a building cannot exceed the foundation which it's built on. When we go straying off into foreign area, when we are lured away from our initial purpose, what we're really here to do, then the scope and the shape and the size of our life will end up being significantly different than it was intended to be. Just remember that. All right, let me pause for a moment while I collect my thoughts, and I want to return to a couple additional ideas. Okay, returning to the next point that I wanted to make, and this is closely aligned with temptation. Most of the temptation that we fall prey to is not, when it comes to big things in life, is not impulse. It's simply directions or patterns of living that have not been carefully thought through. So the way I word this principle in the notes for the morning is this: it is possible to work yourself poor. One of the principles that God has instituted for human living, whether you wish to receive this or not, it's in the Word, and it's up to us to decide how or if we will obey that principle. And it's this: it's the principle of Sabbath. And so when I say a man can work himself poor, what I'm suggesting is that a man who does not pause from his everyday work life, a man who does not pause to be refreshed, to be restored, and to reflect on his life, a man who never takes time to think about his life, is likely to continue to make poor judgments in the moments where decisions are called for. It is only when we have time to distance ourselves from the actions, from the daily behaviors, it's only when we have the time to reflect on what we know and how we are applying what we know, and if in fact we are properly applying what we know, it's only then when we can make course corrections. Haven't we all been so busy doing that it's almost, we just don't have time to think, is a phrase that is often used. I'm so busy doing it, I don't have time to think about. I don't have time to think about what I'm doing. Wasn't that true? Have you ever gotten so busy during your week that contemplation, reflection, prayer were just sort of pushed to the side? And I find myself, if I have 2 or 3 days outside of some reflection and contemplation, if I have 2 or 3 days outside of reading something meaningful and beneficial that is going to refocus and align my thinking, I find myself drifting off purpose. It doesn't take long. And if you're a busy man, as I suspect many of you are, that busyness pulls you off course more quickly. So it's sort of like this: if your life represents a boat and you're in still water, a little bit of wind, a little bit of current will tend to cause your boat to drift a little bit. But if you operate in a fast-paced world with many responsibilities, and I know some of you listening do, it's almost as if the little rowboat, which is your life, has now been cut loose into a severe current. And it takes only a matter of hours or days or perhaps a few weeks for that little boat to be taken so far off course, so far off where it was to be. And that's the way it is when a man does not pause from his everyday labors and take time to reflect and think. So remember this, Sabbath is a gift that God gives to us. It is not something that He expects us to do as a legal obligation just because. And when we work constantly, we can literally work ourselves poor. During our study time this morning, you may have heard me reference the text in Philippians where it says that we are to function together in community as those who help and support each other. I hope you heard that. That we're not only to look out for our own interests, but we are also in that community context to look out for the interests of each other. Now, one of the other things that I said is that while life balance sounds like such a great idea, that in fact, if we are to live unique purposes, our lives are really not going to be uniformly balanced. They're simply going to be prioritized correctly. And that you and I, given that we are different individuals, different temperaments, different genetics, each called to a certain place as well as a certain purpose, our purposes are going to be somewhat distinct and different. Remember what we said, that's going to make our lives look individual. That human beings have a herd mentality, we don't like to look too much different than everybody else, and yet all of the great revolutionaries, the people who have made something happen, their lives look different in many ways. They were odd. Their practices were different. But their practices were different because their practices were designed to help them achieve purpose. That means that the man who is good in one thing is going to be only mediocre at something else and may even be flat out bad at other things. This is one of the gifts that God gives us by saying that we need to come together into community and serve each other. So if I am, we'll say on a scale of 1 to 10, if I am a 1 at something and you are a 10 at that thing, then in community you can help to serve me by taking your 10 capability and assisting me in an area where I'm only a 1. And I likewise, if I have a 10 capability person in some area, in community, I can help you in an area where you are only a 2 or a 3. And in that way, in community, we give each other the freedom and the liberty to be unique and distinct in purpose, to be, as it were, off balance in the right way, because we can focus our time and our energy on fulfilling those unique callings and purposes that are ours. And others come around us to help us in areas where we are weak. And so I know we don't like the concept, especially as guys, we can be a little uncomfortable with the idea that we are not complete in ourselves, that we actually are weak in certain areas as well as strong in other areas. Remember this. A weakness doesn't have to be an indication that you're inadequate. A weakness is simply an area that you are not focusing on because you are giving additional time and energy and focus to an area where you are strong. That's why we work best when we work in community, and part of the purpose for community is not just to help those who are, quote, naturally weak, but it's because we are all weak in certain areas because we have chosen to be strong in others. All right, a couple of final points here. We'll be quick about these. If you find yourself in a position of financial difficulty today, understand this. It probably didn't take you only a day to get into financial difficulty. If it took you only a day to get into some form of real financial difficulty, chances are underlying that outward apparent financial difficulty, there has been a season of not doing everything possible in order to manage your finances well. But even if you have done everything right and today you find yourself in a position of financial difficulty, let me just say this. It probably has taken a while to get into something, and it will take a while to get out of something. Use that season to develop patience and perseverance, and to develop qualities of innovative thinking and capability, and greater levels of personal confidence. The first crisis that a man goes through seems to be overwhelming. He's never gone through a crisis before. All of this business about being in a crisis mode is new to him and very much overwhelming. But over a period of time, if a man experiences multiple crises, he becomes stronger in character, stronger in the qualities that allow him to withstand the rigors and the external pressures. Two final thoughts we're going to wrap up with. The first is this, and this is something that I learned in business a number of years ago. Many people operate under an agricultural model of finances, which is incomplete or sometimes ineffective. I had to learn this the hard way in managing a small business. And something goes something like this. And anybody who has been in any kind of a small business will instantly identify with what I'm saying. There are times when the pace is fast and hectic, and there's a lot of demands because we'll say that life is good. There's plenty of work, there's plenty of sales, there's plenty of whatever it is that you do in order to generate income, and it's good, and it's everything that you can do to stay on top of providing the service or producing the product that you produce. In other words, it's the season where income is coming in. And at seasons like that, it can be our temptation to slack off on planting. Because after all, in an agricultural model, each season is separate. You prepare the soil at a certain time, you plant seed at a certain time, you nurture that growing plant at through a season of time, and then ultimately you harvest and store for future planting and for consumption. So in the agricultural model of wealth building, each season is separate from the other, and you're not doing them at the same time. You know, you're obviously not trying to harvest from the plant that's still growing. But that's not the way it is in advanced financial systems that we live in, such as those today. Even in good times, it is essential for a man to be planting, knowing full well that that good time is sooner or later going to come to an end. When I was younger, I made the mistake of not selling product during a busy time. I felt I'm too busy. I just need to keep riding this crest, this wave of prosperity, and it's going to be good. Well, sooner or later, the crest dropped off. Sooner or later, the gush became a trickle, and then the trickle became nothing. And I realized after a couple of cycles of this that I could not possibly wait to sow for the next season in life until I was done harvesting. That even in the middle of harvesting, in a business sense, it was necessary for me to break from the harvesting in order to plant seeds for the next harvest and to nurture things that were already growing. Otherwise, the day would come when the harvesting would stop and there would be nothing left, and I would sit through a dry and barren season while I waited for things that I would plant during the barren season to grow again. Now, most of you can make some sort of practical application. Most of us find ourselves in situations where we don't just make money for a season and it's all good and we can just stop and live off the harvest for years of our life. So guys, even when you are in the midst of busy seasons, don't neglect caring for and investing in yourself in ways which make you relevant financially to the needs of society as they're changing. Don't fail to invest in yourself. You are one of the greatest assets that you have. Don't ever forget that. God has given you to take care of yourself. And so you need to care for yourself and invest in yourself and keep yourself up to date and relevant according to the needs of society at this time. We're going to wrap up with a quote that I like from Joyce Myers, and this is just a paraphrase that I heard during a podcast that I was listening to recently. It's not as if it's a new idea, but I think it's a helpful and timely reminder at the end of this. We each have a choice, she says. We will never have enough, and you can fill in the blank, enough of. In this case, she is implying financial resources. We will never have enough to be free from worry. So you think about that. We all think that if we only had a little bit more, we wouldn't worry as much. Ask people who have more. See if they ever worry. You'll find that they do. Let me repeat this. You will never have enough to be free from worry. So you can either seek first your own kingdom, or you can seek first God. Now here's the interesting thing, and I'm inserting this. Joyce didn't say this, but I'm inserting this. When we are invited to be sons and daughters of the kingdom, when we are invited to be God's sons and daughters, here's the cool thing. What God says is this kingdom is ours. He has chosen to share it with us. So when we invest in the kingdom of heaven as a mentality, when that's our mindset, when that's our value, we are actually not investing in someone else's kingdom. We are investing in the kingdom that is going to be ours to inhabit and to steward. This is, so I can either seek first the kingdom of God or I can seek my own. And we resume with what she's saying here. And she says, when you seek your kingdom, there is no promise to lean on. In other words, if you want to go after your kingdom first, you're on your own. But when you seek first the Father's kingdom, there are promises which accompany seeking His kingdom first. I'm not going to bother to unpack that. What I'd like you to do is just meditate on it. When you seek first your own kingdom, you have no promises to rely on, and you are the only one who is going to look after the interests of that kingdom. But when you seek first the kingdom of God, and as the verse says, and His righteousness, then you are seeking to put first the values, the principles of a kingdom whose inhabitants are all called to look out for each other's interests. That's a promise that we can all lean on. Guys, I hope this has been encouraging to you. Catch you again next week.